Hi, Dreamers. I have a story that I have been wanting to share with you that kind of goes along with the bank robbery cases that we covered a few weeks ago. I was initially going to bring this exclusively to patrons of California Dreaming while I was on this two-week hiatus, but I really don't like putting unsolved cases behind a paywall. So I've decided to take a tiny hiatus from my hiatus and bring you the special bonus episode for all to listen to. The Tale of the FBI's Most Wanted, number 489. On December 8, 2007, the FBI placed fugitive Jason Derrick Brown on their most wanted list. You know the list. Once you're on it, the only way to get off of it is to either have the charges against you dropped, to be captured, or to be dead. Brown actually currently resides amongst 9 other wanted murderers in the top 10 most wanted, along with a $200,000 reward for information leading to his capture. So what did Jason Derrick Brown do to wind up on the FBI's most wanted list? Let's get into that. If you look around the internet at pictures of Brown, you are going to see 2 different incarnations of the fugitive. You see, he has not been seen or heard from since 2004. That's 15 years. You'll find computer-generated age-progressed images of Brown, but you will also see the last known photos ever taken of him. His look was so quintessential early 2000s surfer chic. Spiky blonde hair. I can't say for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if he frosted his tips at some point. Lots of pics of him with no shirt on, board shorts, posing with some of his favorite toys, his boat, his motorcycle, his Cadillac Escalade. And when he does have a shirt on, he liked to wear those shiny shirts with the top buttons undone, kind of like Dwayne The Rock Johnson circa his wrestling days. There's pics of him at restaurants or bars, with friends, drinks in hand, and his look is definitely dated. But Brown just seemed normal for the time. South Orange County, 2000s. Born July 1st, 1969, he was a guy who liked to surf. He had been an Eagle Scout. He attended Laguna Beach High School. He was raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He served his mission from 1988 to 1990 in Paris. He spoke French fluently. He earned his master's in international business. He resided in some of the most exclusive areas of Orange County, including Dana Point and Corona Del Mar. At some point, he moved to Salt Lake City, Utah, where he owned and operated a couple of quote-unquote businesses, but I'll get into that more a little bit later. One was called Toys Unlimited, and the other, On the Doorstep Advertising. Brown had a taste for expensive things. He enjoyed portraying himself as a man of wealth, and he craved the attention it brought him. There was one slight problem, though. Brown wasn't really earning the kinds of money to afford him the lifestyle that he wanted. By 2004, Brown was deep in debt, but the lifestyle he was living was not something he was willing to sacrifice, nor was he really able to generate the kinds of income he needed to maintain it. Drowning in debt, reaching the end of his rope, he would turn to crime, eventually committing the ultimate crime, murder. And once he had been identified in the media as the one responsible for it, he ghosted. And thus, our Eagle Scout, our Mormon missionary, Orange County surfer guy, Golden Boy, winds up on the top 10 most wanted list, where it seems as though he has a seemingly permanent residency. And it is a list that has seen the likes of Theodore Bundy, Andrew Cunanan, James Earl Ray, and Osama bin Laden. The most recent addition to the list is a man named Eugene Palmer. He became most wanted number 523 on May 28, 2019, wanted for the September 24, 2012 murder of his daughter-in-law in Stony Point, New York. The FBI has a pretty good clearance rate when it comes to their most wanted, but there is that small percentage, maybe 6 to 7% of those, who just managed to stay one step ahead of the FBI. And Jason Brown is one of them. Scroll through the images of the most wanted, and Jason Derek Brown has the most average name, the most average look, the most average build, the most average height, the most average everything when it comes to the company he keeps being on that exclusive list. That's what makes him stand out from most others. But on the flip side of that, it's what makes him the most innocuous. Brown has been on the run for almost 15 years, and he has managed to pass by countless people, and nobody would ever think twice about it. Over the years, he has been somebody's neighbor, somebody's friend, somebody's boyfriend even. Never knowing that back on Thanksgiving weekend of 2004, on September 29th, just a little bit after 10 a.m. in the city of Phoenix, Arizona, Brown would gun down a man who was just out doing his job that day. It was the Monday morning following Thanksgiving. 24-year-old Robert Palomares was working that day at his job as an armored truck guard. He was picking up the weekend deposits from the AMC movie theaters located at 4915 East Ray Road in Phoenix. Those holiday weekends usually bring in some pretty good movie crowds. Looks like the big box office moneymakers that weekend were National Treasure, SpongeBob SquarePants the Movie, Alexander, and Christmas with the Cranks. The armored car driver pulled up and parked in front of the entrance of the movie theater. His partner, Robert, he quickly walked into the theater, was given the weekend deposit by the manager, and he signed the receipt for the cash, a total of $56,000, and he walked back out of the theater towards the waiting truck. But before Robert was able to make it back into the safety of his armored vehicle, 6 shots pierced the otherwise quiet morning. The gunman, who had a hoodie pulled over his head, grabbed the bag of money. 5 out of the 6 bullets struck Robert in the head. He was armed, but he had no chance to unholster his weapon. The killer had no intentions of exchanging gunfire with Robert. He had no intentions of this being just a stick-up. The plan was to kill him and grab the money unimpeded. Before the gunman made his getaway, his image was captured on surveillance, dropping the money bag and picking it back up again. He ran towards a nearby alley where he got onto a bike and sped away. As Robert lay on the ground, mortally wounded, his driver, following company policy, stayed in the truck and radioed the office. From there, 911 was called. His driver has been shot several times. He's still moving, but he needs an ambulance quickly. He's dying. Paramedics arrived quickly, but the 911 caller was correct. There was nothing that could be done to save Robert. Only 24 years old, and he would leave behind a young widow as well. His grieving family, especially his mom, who felt so strongly that this job was so dangerous. Robert's grandmother would be the one to have to break the news to his little brother, Derek. They had been so close growing up. He looked up to him. Robert was protective and loving. The Palomares family was shattered in an instant. And though nothing would ever make the devastation of Robert's loss fade away, the one thing that could have brought them some small bit of relief would be the one thing they have yet to get to this day. Justice. And thus began an unbelievably frustrating manhunt for Robert's killer that has now gone on for nearly 15 long years. There had been a rapid response to the killing. The Phoenix police were out there in force. Roadblocks were erected. Every artery in and out of the area had a checkpoint. Every driver questioned, every car searched. Helicopters in the air, canines on the ground. Witnesses were questioned. Most heard the shots, few saw, and they didn't get that great of a look at the suspect. He was white, maybe Hispanic. He had on a dark hoodie and rode away on a mountain bike. He was seen pedaling harder than the typical cyclist would be pedaling. So once the pieces started falling into place, witnesses realized it was the killer fleeing the scene. The FBI was brought in because armored truck robbery is their jurisdiction. Just like bank robbery, it's a federal offense. The killing of Robert Palomares shook the community. He was a young man just out doing his job and gunned down for $56,000. The violence of it had the community angered and upset, especially when an arrest wasn't immediately made. But the leads were so vague and the evidence was scant. The Phoenix police and the FBI were looking for the most basic white guy ever, on a bike. And the crime scene was an awful mess. There was blood all over the pavement, with some bullet fragments strewn about. One shot that missed Robert shattered a box office window. And from the looks of how all of this went down, Robert likely didn't even see what was coming. He never got his gun from his holster, and the witnesses nearby outside the theater heard nothing prior to the shooting. The killer made no verbal demands for the money. He just shot him. This was an execution. Then, a break in the case. The same day as the killing, from the skies, the police helicopter spotted a bike that appeared to have been ditched less than a mile away from the theater in a drainage expanse. Detectives rushed over to the scene, along with the crime lab. They wanted to get whatever evidence they could off the bike before they moved it. In the meantime, mall employees as well as shoppers were being interviewed by the police. From what they were hearing from these witnesses, this robbery was something that had been planned for some time. They had noticed in the weeks leading up to the murder, a silver BMW that was parked nearby, and a guy just sitting in it, watching. But this didn't quite seem to mesh with what they knew. The guy on the bike didn't seem to have the means to be owning a BMW. He was on a bike and dressed kinda shabbily. Well, investigators would get some answers the following day. A fingerprint was lifted off the bike and a search of the database came up with a match and a name, Jason Derek Brown. Okay, so who is this guy? As it turned out, Brown was in the National Crime Database because of a previous arrest 4 years earlier in North Carolina. He was caught stealing golf clubs from a sporting goods store. His prints also came up in a search with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Brown had made a recent purchase in Salt Lake City just a few weeks before the shooting. He took a firearms class at Totally Awesome Guns and Range and purchased a handgun afterwards. He had passed the background check, and his prints and photograph were entered into the state and federal databases. The same day Robert was killed, it was nearly midnight going into the next day, Salt Lake City FBI agents were able to track down Brown's firearms instructor, Clark Apashian. Clark told authorities that Brown drove a really nice silver 3 Series BMW, and he was a pretty laid-back, Southern California surfer type of guy. Though Clark's firearms class was full, he went ahead and squeezed Brown in. But once he got to know Brown a little bit better, he came to see him as a cocky, arrogant little punk who really had no idea what he was doing or how to shoot a gun. As a matter of fact, he had accidentally fired one round into somebody's truck, causing $1,300 in damage, which he ultimately paid. After Brown had some instruction and practice using a 9mm Glock, he managed to pass the concealed carry test. Then Brown told Clark he wanted to buy a handgun. He tried to suggest a small caliber weapon that would be easy to use, but Brown insisted he wanted something bigger. He asked, "What is the most powerful weapon?" Clark told him the .45 caliber, though he continued to push for a smaller caliber. But Brown insisted he wanted the .45, so that's what he bought. In the ammo, it had to be the most powerful too. So Clark fingerprinted and photographed Brown as required, and the FBI were able to download his photo and send it back to their counterparts in Phoenix. They couldn't help but notice the smirk on Brown's face in the photo. They examined the picture. They looked at him. This is the look he has on his face, knowing that he was acquiring the one thing that he was going to use to kill somebody. So, with a name, a face, and a vehicle, investigators had their starting point. They soon received a report regarding a guy staying at a motel who had been seen putting a mountain bike into a BMW, just about a mile away from the crime scene. It was confirmed that this was indeed Jason Brown that had reserved a room there, and he used a Salt Lake City address when he registered. They also retrieved surveillance footage of Brown in the lobby of the motel the day of the killing. So they were on to him. And from there, the leads started flowing in. The FBI obtained Brown's cell phone information, and by using cell phone pings, they triangulated his locations following the robbery. After Brown murdered Robert, he went into a 24-hour fitness gym. He had a bag with him, and when he emerged from the locker room, he had changed his clothes and left the bag in the locker for a short period of time. Later on, he came back and retrieved the bag. From there, his cell phone records showed that he was heading away from Phoenix. There was also an influx of calls being made to members of his family in California. And 2 days after the murder, Brown made a $2,300 cash deposit into his bank in Dana Point. The FBI is thinking, okay, great, we've got this guy. He was indicted for murder and a warrant was issued. And it looked as though they'd have Brown in custody in no time. Yeah, not so much. It felt as though Jason Brown was within reach every step of the way. He was right there. Law enforcement were tracking him. They were getting close, but as each day passed without having taken him into custody, Phoenix police and the FBI were growing increasingly concerned that he was growing increasingly desperate. Brown was cunning, and he was dangerous. And they were getting so close to catching him, literally missing him by just minutes. A week after Brown killed Robert Palomares, the FBI and the Phoenix police were closing in. Along with the robbery and murder charges, they tacked on a third federal charge of unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Using all the resources at their disposal, along with Brown's phone, bank, and credit card records, they were certain that he had gone to Orange County, California, and was hiding with the assistance of his family. And they were right. From the information they garnered from their intel, Brown was hiding at his sister's house in Rancho Santa Margarita. But just as they were preparing for their raid, the news in Phoenix broke that a suspect in Robert's shooting had been identified. His surfer boy picture was splashed across the news and headlines all over Arizona. They wanted to get the word out to be on the lookout for this guy. They would say they thought they were doing a public service. But what they actually did was tip Brown off that they knew who he was and they were on to him. A friend saw Brown on the news. That friend called him and was like, "Hey man, I saw you on the news. What's up?" And that was it. He could not stay put at his sister's house. That would for sure be one of the first places law enforcement would be looking. At his family. Within an hour of the breaking news in Phoenix, the FBI, police, and the SWAT team stormed not only Brown's sister's house, but the entire block. But he was gone. According to his sister, they just missed him. What was he driving? She told them a silver BMW. If their raid had happened a mere 30 minutes earlier, they'd have caught him. Again, one step ahead. A ghost. To make matters even worse, Brown's sister lied to law enforcement. He wasn't driving his BMW, he was actually in his Cadillac Escalade. I don't know if they slapped her with any charges for lying to police, but they kind of blew it off anyway. People lie to them all the time, so they take everything with a grain of salt. When they radioed out their reports, they included the information about the BMW, but they also knew he had an Escalade, so that information was out there too. They knew to look for everything. A short time after the raid, Brown used a credit card at a gas station to fill up south of Orange County, which of course is headed towards the international border that California shares with Mexico. Law enforcement made a beeline for that gas station and they looked at their surveillance and he was indeed in the Escalade. They continued to track Brown for the next 24 hours as he made his way through San Diego. He was using his credit cards. He was seen on traffic and surveillance videos. He withdrew some money very close to the border near Tijuana. And from there, he sent several packages to his brother, David. Brown sent him a gun that he had stolen from his brother's house. He sent some clothing, all of it warm weather stuff. He sent a camera, memory cards, some CDs, and his laptop. The memory cards and CDs, those were just all pictures of Brown, places he'd gone, things that he'd seen. It gave investigators a glimpse of who this guy was. The FBI kept an eye on the post office box all the stuff was going to. They knew when David was receiving all of these items. They assumed that Brown was attempting to get rid of all that was his old life, as he was preparing to move on to a new life as a fugitive. They also came to learn that Brown loved the movie Heat. And if you aren't familiar, it stars Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Val Kilmer, John Voight, and Tom Sizemore. De Niro portrays a highly skilled career criminal, and he has a crew of four guys. They enlist a fifth guy to help them steal $1.6 million worth of bearer bonds from an armored car. That fifth recruit ends up killing two of the three armored guards somewhat impulsively, and they did not expect nor want this heist to escalate to murder. Well, in this movie, De Niro's character, Neil McCauley, lives by a strict code. Don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat coming around the corner. And that's what they think Brown was doing, letting go of his things because the heat was around every corner. It was part of his plan, this movie, De Niro's philosophy. He was making it his own. He was going to shed everything that was Jason Derek Brown and become somebody new. The last package he sent to his brother came from Portland, Oregon. After that, Brown fell off the face of the earth. There were no more phone calls made from his cell phone, no more ATM withdrawals. His credit cards went dormant. Brown was cunning and resourceful, unlike the average bank robber. Portland turned out to be another dead end. He ghosted again. Meanwhile, back in Arizona, tips continued pouring in, and eventually law enforcement heard from the guy whose truck was shot by Brown at that firearms class. The day before the robbery and murder of Robert Palomares, this guy and Brown were target practicing by shooting paper plates, and that's when Brown shot his truck. He confronted him about it, so Brown took one of the paper plates, jotted down his name and phone number along with the same Salt Lake City address that he used to register at that motel, as well as his license plate number, with a promise to pay for the damages, which he eventually did. Though this really wasn't going to help investigators find their fugitive, it did provide them with another solid piece of evidence. The bullet that was recovered from the truck was the same type and caliber as the bullets that killed Robert. This solidly linked Brown to what they believed to be the murder weapon. Still, none of this was any good without their suspect in custody. So investigators began looking backwards into the past of Jason Derrick Brown, just to see if there was anything that would reveal what moves he might make next. They wanted to know about his past, who he had been before he was a wanted murderer. It didn't take long for the investigation into Brown's life to reveal that the fugitive apple didn't fall too far from the fugitive tree. Brown's dad, as it turned out, was a ghost himself. The agents and detectives on this case, the more they learned of Jason Brown, the more they found themselves scratching their heads. He had grown up with all of life's opportunities within grasp. He had everything that would have seen him lead a productive life. More often than not, when investigators dig into the background of a criminal, they find troubling factors in their family history. Poverty, addiction, abuse, and the like. But not Brown. He was raised in affluent Orange County, California, in Laguna Beach, where today the median home value is $2.1 million, and that's in a market in a slight downturn. A fun fact for you guys, in 2016, the home at 1101 Marina Drive in Laguna Beach became the most expensive home ever sold in Orange County for a cool $45 million. The second most expensive home in Laguna was only $28 million. Yeah, only. But I'm not saying Jason Brown had it all like that, but I mean, come on, he's not hurting. And I told you part of his upbringing already. His grandparents lived in the same neighborhood, so he had close family ties. He was an Eagle Scout, is a versatile athlete in school. He graduated from Laguna Beach High. He went to college in Idaho. He had a two-year mission in France, becoming fluent in the language. When he returned from France, he married a fellow missionary at a temple service in Los Angeles. He went on to earn his MBA. Jason Brown was well on his way to carving out a niche for himself in corporate America when suddenly things in his life took a nosedive, and this included his marriage. Somewhere along the line after earning his MBA, something in Brown just turned. It was some sort of internal, centralized evolution that he went through. He suddenly reinvented himself from the straight-laced Eagle Scout Mormon missionary to someone completely different. He turned into a player, I guess, for lack of a better word. He became a partier, and he developed a taste for expensive things, boats and cars, and a taste for pretty women. And he fancied himself quite the high roller when it came to high-stakes gambling. And all of this seemed to stem from Brown's dad, John. What John did? Your guess is as good as mine. He'd just head on over across the border into Tijuana and come back with large stacks of cash. My first guess would be drug trafficking, but I was really unable to find any information as to what John Brown was into. He was a mystery. Though, just like his son, he was also a gambler and a player, and he had spoiled his kids rotten. All the nice things, all the fancy things. And Dad showed them all the ways to get the nice and fancy things without really working for it. Traditional jobs be damned, right? But why then put on all that work for the MBA if there was never really any intentions of using it? Maybe just another part of the game? An extension of ever-growing egos of the Brown men? Perhaps. But then investigators found out another bit of tantalizing information. John Brown vanished also, back in 1994. 10 years earlier. So bring on the conspiracy theorists. There's a belief that John Brown and Jason Brown might be fugitives together. But the FBI really doesn't believe it, and they don't have any facts or evidence to point to that being true. But as long as nobody knows where either one of them are, anything is possible. Both of Brown's siblings, both his sister and his brother, have refused all requests for interviews and have been uncooperative as can be. Agents pressured both of them hard for information to no avail. The blood definitely ran thicker than water in the Brown family. The FBI point to the issue of Brown's silver BMW. They wanted that car. They asked his brother David repeatedly, "Where is it?" He had no idea. Over and over again, denied knowledge of where the vehicle was at. Well, at some point, unbeknownst to the FBI, David had gone to Las Vegas, got into one of Brown's storage units that he maintained there, and picked up that silver BMW. And it wasn't just to have it and to drive it. He brought it back to California and had the entire thing detailed inside and out. And things don't stay unbeknownst to the FBI for very long. They caught wind of this and became very beknownst as to what he had done. And they quickly slapped the handcuffs on him, arrested him, and charged him with making false statements. He pleaded guilty and received 3 years of probation. The BMW had been an important piece of evidence that the FBI never got the chance to search for evidence before David Brown had wiped it clean. And they're pretty sure both of Brown's siblings know more than they're letting on when it comes to his whereabouts, because they don't think Brown could go for long periods of time without communicating with his family. So they kept digging. And the further they went, the more they discovered how much of a con artist Jason Brown actually was. He pulled off scam after scam after scam as he went along, using his good looks, and that's debatable, but whatever, along with his charm to perpetrate the frauds. He bought everything he had on credit, and then he just never paid. Boats, cars, everything. He'd go to make the purchase, and poof, he was gone. All of Brown's businesses were shams. All of them bogus. He started up the quote-unquote picture-perfect modeling agency in the Austin, Texas area. There, he targeted female students at the University of Texas, and for a fee of $5,000, he would do their modeling shoots. It was also a way for him to meet women as well. Brown even had the audacity to pose for his own phony modeling agency as well. So this leaves us wondering, how did Brown go from con artist with the fake business and scams to a violent murderer? The FBI would say it's the greed. All the scams he was pulling, you can't run from that forever. Something's got to give, and eventually it was all going to catch up to him. The greed was driving him. The desire to keep and maintain the fake life that he had forged. And the only way to do that was to pull off one big Heat-style heist. And if he had to kill to do it, so be it. How did he get there? How did this murder come so easy to this man? It's hard to say when a criminal crosses that threshold, but to me, Robert Palmeris' death was another part of Jason Brown's fantasy life. To him, this was a movie, and Robert was just playing his role. Was it that simple for Brown? I don't know. He came off to me as really unbothered by it all. He just walked up, got off 6 shots, 5 straightened to Robert's head. He grabbed the money and biked away, off to a brand new carefree life. 6 weeks after Robert's murder, investigators discovered Brown's Escalade in Portland, Oregon. It had been abandoned and vandalized at the Portland International Airport. And the manner in which it was found, where it was found, investigators were pretty sure he wanted them to find it. He wanted them to think he took a flight out of the country. but there was no indication that he had done so. And it was also around this time that the man whose truck had been shot the day before the murder by Brown, he received a cashier's check in the amount of $1,300, which covered the cost of the damage to his car, along with the gift card for the man's son to Toys R Us. These are the two faces of Jason Derrick Brown. The same man who coldly shot Robert Palomares in the back of the head 5 times is the same man who gifted a boy a card to Toys R Us because having shot his dad's truck scared him. And he'd be the same guy to move in next to you and have you over for a barbecue or go play golf with you or sit down next to you at a bar and buy you a drink. Ghostly and self-contradictory. The investigation also led to a realtor named Ellen Robinson. She had showed Brown a rental house on her block in the summer of 2003. He took a quick look-see around the house, but his main interest was the garage. He had lots of things that he needed to store in the garage. And he told her that he was in international sales, an importer and exporter of golf equipment to Asia. The garage had been packed solid with golf equipment. Neighbors described Brown as kind of a big kid, though he was generous and always willing to be helpful. You know, neighborly. He'd go golfing with some of them. The kids on the block liked to hang out with him too. He'd take them boating. He had all the toys a guy could desire. The BMW, the Escalade, a Rubicon, a customized boat, a Yamaha motorcycle, 2 quads, and 2 dirt bikes. Then, about 6 months later, Brown suddenly moved out. He told his neighbors that he had to tend to a sick family member back in California. And like that, he was gone. However, 2 weeks prior to Robert's murder, Ellen received a call from Brown. She had given him a standing offer to come visit and stay at her place anytime. So for 10 days, he quietly occupied her guest room. Totally polite, totally considerate, wouldn't even eat the food that she had offered. Each day, he would leave as if he had a job to attend to and then return home in the evening. Investigators believed that he was casing the mall the movie theater was located in. 3 days before the murder, he left Ellen's home and checked into the motel. It was 10 days later when Ellen saw her former houseguest on the news, accused of robbery and murder of an armored car guard. There he was, his face on the news. She could not believe that he was capable of such a thing. She grabbed her phone and called him. It went to voicemail. She left him a message to tell him that there's something wrong. You've got to come fix this. They think you've done this crime. You better come straighten this out. Not for a second did she think the news reports had it right. Not the Jason Brown that she knew. He was so kind and polite. A murderer, he was not. Ellen did point one thing out, though. Her cat, who generally likes people, did not like Jason Brown while he was staying at her home. Her cat wouldn't go anywhere near him. So take that to mean whatever you'd like. But those who knew Jason Brown well, his closest friends and confidants, they knew him to be struggling in the weeks leading up to the murder. He had not been his usual self. He was really down, perhaps even depressed. He really didn't have a place to stay. He was couch surfing and his money had dried up. In Dreamers, I don't really care for Jason Brown being described as quote-unquote depressed because depression is a very real thing that many people struggle with, and to describe him as depressed takes away from that. He's depressed because he's broke and his scams aren't working and he isn't willing to put his MBA to good use to earn a proper living. Doesn't qualify for being depressed. I'd say he'd be suffering from whiny, spoiled, rotten brat syndrome. That sounds a bit more accurate. He wasn't able to support the lifestyle that he had become accustomed to. He'd sit around all day and watch crime stories on TV. I mean, who does that, right? I'm not judging. And he talked about robbing an armored car being the best way to go if you were to commit a crime. And yeah, the investigators were learning all of this stuff about him, but none of it was leading them to his whereabouts. The Phoenix police and the FBI were under a tremendous amount of pressure to solve this, not only from their respective departments, but from the community and, of course, from the victim's family. But the investigation dragged on and it was growing cold quickly. What investigators thought would be an easy catch turned out to be anything but. The months turned into several months, turned into years, turned into several years. And here we are today, closing in on 15 years since Robert Palomares was gunned down in cold blood, and still no closer to finding Jason Brown than they were all those years ago. He has managed to not appear on one single piece of surveillance video anywhere. Not one hit on his fingerprints or his DNA. No hit on his social security number. Not one single bit of credit card activity. Thousands and thousands of tips leading to thousands and thousands of dead ends. He supposedly had been spotted in Vegas and Key West and Vancouver. Dozens of basic type average men have been brought in, fingerprinted, and found to not be Jason Brown. And his ghost continues to haunt those determined to seek him out. The pressure was kicked up a notch, little more than 3 years after Robert's murder, on December 8, 2007, when Jason Brown was added to the FBI's most exclusive club. Not just an entry onto their most wanted list, but he made it into the top 10. Entry number 489. And the reasons why Brown made it into the top 10 was because of the particularly violent nature of his crime, because of his cunning behavior, because he is intellectual, capable of both extreme violence and manipulative charm. Because he's fluent in both French and Spanish. Because he's athletic. And he's healthy and an avid, outdoorsy kind of guy. These qualities elevated his case to the top. And there's a $200,000 reward out there. So if someone knows where Jason Brown is, they're not going to call because they want to do their civic duty. They're going to do it because they're motivated by the money. Because people who know Jason Brown like Jason Brown. And it's going to take just the right person to hear about his crimes, to know who he is and be willing to call in that tip. And it doesn't even have to be a call. There's an FBI website, and they have a top 10 most wanted app for your smartphone. The 10 fugly faces of the most wanted fugitives in America right at your fingertips. How convenient. The theory that seems the most popular is that Brown, true to form, is a moocher. That he may be mooching his way through life all these years on the run. Charming the ladies, using them, and moving on to the next. But whatever he's doing, wherever he's at, he is considered to be an extremely dangerous man and a serious threat to public safety. As for Robert's family, long gone is the anger felt about the killer of their loved one being free. For now, the only satisfaction can be found is in knowing that no matter where on earth Jason Derek Brown is walking, he is the one living in constant fear, forever looking over his shoulder and having to live with the burden of what he did. Though I believe Brown would be constantly looking over his shoulder, I can't help but think that the years have caused the anxiety to ease up. Maybe he's let his guard down. He may one day soon slip up. But to be burdened with what he did? Guilty conscience eating away at him? I doubt it. Remember, this was all a movie to him. Robert Palomares was just a plot point in Jason Derrick Brown's pathetic little world. Jason Derrick Brown is a Caucasian male and has gone by the known aliases of Jason D. Brown, Derrick Brown, Greg Johnson, Harlene Johnson, Greg Harlene Johnson, John Brown, and Jay Brown. He was born July 1st, 1969, but has also used the birth date of January 17th, 1971. In a few weeks, as of the date of this recording, Brown will be turning 50 years old. He has blonde hair, green eyes, he's 5'10" or 1.78 meters tall and weighs approximately 170 to 180 pounds or 77 to 81 kilograms. He kind of resembles actor Sean Penn. As a matter of fact, sometime in 2008, Sean Penn's stunt double was detained as suspected of being Brown until fingerprints proved otherwise. Brown is an avid golfer, snowboarder, skier, and dirt biker. He's been known to travel to France and Mexico and has ties to California, Arizona, and Utah. They have not ruled out that he may be someplace warm, but because he sent his warm weather clothing to his brother, they believe it's possible he may have fled into Western Canada, possibly Vancouver. He is considered to be armed and extremely dangerous, if he is still alive. Thank you for listening to this bonus episode of California Dreaming. I'm your host, Roseanne. And until next time, sweet dreams.